Okay, hi class, it's Dr. Fields. We are now up to our lecture on dissociative disorders. Dissociative disorders is included in chapter 6 of your textbook. Towards the end of the chapter, it's not a lengthy section. It only encompasses three different kinds of disorders. But I definitely feel like these disorders are some of the more interesting ones, or some of the most interesting ones, especially dissociative identity disorder, which you are going to see in the one video that I chose for this unit. It's a lengthy video, but I think it does an excellent job of illustrating what multiple personality disorder, or now termed dissociative identity disorder, really looks like. So watch that, and then you can return to the lecture. Okay, so I'm assuming you've all seen the video. Very interesting, right? That is basically what we're going to be talking about. Are these kinds of dissociative disorders, in which dissociative identity disorder is one of them. Okay? So we're going to go from the least to the most severe. Okay? So, like I stated earlier, there are only three disorders really in this category. But they're quite fascinating disorders. And they do share a lot in common. Okay? So let's look at the first one. Going on to slide number two. This one is called depersonalization derealization disorder. Okay? The criteria here are the presence or pers of, I'm sorry, the presence of persistent or recurrent experiences of either depersonalization, derealization, or both. Okay, so what are we talking about here? Depersonalization involves experiences of unreality, detachment, or being an outside observer with respect to one's thoughts, feelings, sensations, body, or actions. Example, perceptual alterations, distorted sense of time, unreal or absent self, emotional and or physical numbing. So it's kind of like this experience of, not really being there and being detached from oneself. Kind of like looking at oneself from an outside perspective. And that is a very strange experience. Okay? So derealization is similar with some minor differences. This is again experiences of unreality or detachment with respect to surroundings. So individuals or objects are experienced as unreal, dreamlike, foggy, lifeless, or visually distorted. So this is interesting, right? With depersonalization, it's kind of like an out-of-body experience where you're looking at yourself and, almost from a distance, right? From outside of your body, and looking at yourself as, this kind of strange being, that is not really understanding what's going on, okay, but knows that something is wrong or doesn't feel right, okay? So it's it's essentially like not feeling yourself to an extreme degree, where you feel like an alien. You're looking at yourself like, who am I? Who is this person? And derealization is not feeling like you're detached from your body, but feeling more of like, again, detached from reality, but in the sense that you're not really recognizing your surroundings. So you're kind of looking around, like, here I am in my office, right? I'm trying to imagine this experience. I'm looking at like the couch and the filing cabinet on my desk as like unfamiliar kinds of objects. That look a little bit unusual and weird to me. And it just feels as if I'm in a dream. Okay? So they're similar, but one is more of like looking at yourself like, this unfamiliar kind of person who feels strange, doesn't feel yourself, and the other perspective is looking at your surroundings, what's outside of yourself as being very strange or unreal. But they're both like these kind of dreamlike states that just do not feel like you're in reality, okay? Now, one of the things that may jump out at you right away is this like what schizophrenics feel or people with psychotic disorders? And we haven't talked about that yet, and we will soon. I'm going to briefly just say that the main difference is with a psychosis, the person, they do not understand that their experience is not real. That's the main difference, that when somebody is under the influence of a psychosis, they don't even understand or acknowledge that what their experience is completely fabricated and not real. Where here, these are feelings of unreality. So, in other words, the person knows that this feels strange and they're not, completely out of it to the point where, they have no reality testing. That's a term we use. When you say the person has poor reality testing, it means that, their understanding of what is real and what is not is very low. Okay? So these people know that something's wrong, something doesn't feel right. It feels unreal, but they know that it's a feeling or a state that they're in. They know that this is not the reality, okay? All right. During the depersonalization or derealization experience, again, there I go. See that? Reality testing remains intact. The symptoms cause clinically significant distress or impairment. There's that old DSM-5 catchphrase. And the disturbance is not attributable to physiological effects of a substance or better explained by another mental disorder, right? This just keeps coming on, coming back time and time again. These catchphrases that make sure it's not due to something different and make sure it has some kind of, major impact on their life functioning. So in other words, if you're under the flu, the influence of, let's say, LSD, right, and you have these kinds of experiences, that would not constitute depersonalization, derealization disorder, because that is due to the effects of a substance, okay? And this can also happen with even prescribed medications, especially strong prescription medications. I've had patients tell me that they've had experiences like this with certain medications that were very unpleasant. Okay? So this is a psychological condition in terms of it's due to psychological reasons, it's not due to other reasons. Okay? All right. Moving on to what I would consider more serious is dissociative amnesia. Also, I will say derealization and deperson I'm sorry, derealization, yes, and depersonalization disorder. When this happens, when they have these experiences, they don't last for a terribly long time. So, we're not talking about a person being, under the spell, so to speak, for like days, We're talking about, for a brief period of time, maybe it lasts 10, 15 minutes, maybe even shorter than that, or maybe upwards of like maybe 30 minutes, or an hour, And that's pretty much, the extent of time we're talking about that somebody is going to be experiencing in this. If they're experiencing this for a much longer time than that, then it's usually due to another reason, like a drug of abuse. Okay? Okay, moving on to slide 3, dissociative amnesia. This is an inability to recall important autobiographical information, that's information about the person, usually of a traumatic or stressful nature, that is inconsistent with ordinary forgetting. Dissociative amnesia most often consists of localized or selective amnesia for specific event or events, or generalized amnesia for identity and life history. So it can range. It can go from either forgetting key aspects of a traumatic event or a stressful period of that person's life, all the way to completely forgetting who the person is, who they are. Okay? But it's a personalized forgetting. It's forgetting of their, you know, either, you know, an event that happened to them or who they are, their identity. Okay? People with dissociative amnesia, usually their knowledge and education, you know, what they've learned is intact. They still know how to read and write and everything else. The forgetting is about personal experiences about themselves, who they are. Okay? Again, there's our catchphrase in B, and there's our rule outs in C and D. Now, there's one specifier for dissociative amnesia, and it's quite interesting. It used to be a separate mental condition, and now they've kind of included it with this because it really is an extension of this kind of amnesia. There's dissociative amnesia with dissociative fugue. This is very interesting. So this is when a person apparently travels somewhere, okay, and upon reaching their destination, at some point they become aware that they have no idea why they took this trip, and even in many cases who they even are, okay? So it's a very unusual type of experience and situation, you know, where all of a sudden a person will wake up one day and say, why am I in Florida? What the heck am I doing here? And they may not even know who they are. Be like, who am I and why am I here? This doesn't feel right. So again, you know, forgetting important information about who they are or important autobiographical information in terms of experiences, and in this case, experience of traveling somewhere and not knowing why they did that. So this is a very, very interesting phenomenon, and it's a very, it's basically an extension, like I said, of dissociative amnesia. So again, though, unlike a psychosis, the person, you know, realizes, I mean, we have to assume that, you know, when they intended on traveling and they actually booked their flight, let's say, and you know, made their plans to travel and everything else, at that point, they knew of their reason, whatever that reason was. But then they forget about it and then, again, may even forget who they are. So different from a psychosis where, you know, the person under the psychosis thinks that this is reality, this is, you know, normal, right? Like, I mean, this experience is real and is believable. This person with dissociative amnesia realizes, at least eventually, that something's not right and that you know, something is wrong here. You know, I don't remember why I did this. I don't know who I am. This is, you know, this is not, you know, this is not normal. Okay, now moving to the most serious one, in my estimation, and this is the most interesting one out of the three, I think, for sure. Although some of you may have found dissociative amnesia with fugue very, very interesting, it is. I find this to be one of the most fascinating disorder out of all the psychological disorders. It's called dissociative identity disorder. It used to be called multiple personality disorder. And, you know, my hunch why they got rid of that term is because, you know, we're assuming that this person has one true, real personality. And then kind of created these different kinds of identities. And so dissociative identity disorder really sounds like a better fit. You know, multiple personality disorder is almost a little bit more of like a misnomer. You know, like they don't have many types of true personalities. They have one personality, one real personality is there, but they have created these different identities, or these pseudo personalities, if you will. Okay, so that's why I think they moved towards this term, dissociative identity disorder. Okay, so what this is, it is a disruption of identity characterized by two or more distinct personality states, which may be described, or two or more distinct identity states, which may be described in some cultures as an experience of possession. You know, other cultures may look at this like, you know, this person is possessed by the devil or a spirit or something else, because it certainly can look that way. The disruption in identity involves marked discontinuity in sense of self and sense of agency. So, in other words, in the moments when they're switching into these different identities or personalities, they lose a sense of self in terms of who they are, which is true of all of the dissociative disorders, you know, losing a sense of who you are, sometimes in the short term, sometimes in the long term, okay? Accompanied by related alterations in affect, that means mood, or behavior, or consciousness, memory, perception, cognition, and or sensory motor functioning. In those moments when they become this other identity, you know, there are changes that happen with them. And these changes are congruent with this identity in the moment, but are incongruent with their true self. In other words, it's as if they are becoming a different person or are a different person in that moment. These signs and symptoms may be observed by others or reported by the individual. Recurrent gaps in the recall of everyday events, important personal information, and/or traumatic events that are inconsistent with ordinary forgetting. Okay, and that is the result of being in an altered state of consciousness when they're in a different personality or, you know, identity. And then we have our catchphrase in C and our rule outs in D and E. Okay, fascinating stuff, right? Okay, so let's talk about dissociative disorders in general. So essentially, we're talking about an experience that occurs when a person feels detached from oneself and or one's surroundings, as if he or she is in a dream. They feel as if they are not in reality, and they realize either while they're under the state, if it's like derealization, depersonalization disorder, or eventually realize, if you're talking about dissociative amnesia or dissociative identity disorder, when they switch back to their true self, they eventually realize that this was not reality and that something's wrong, okay? So, you know, it can be best described as a compromised sense of reality or identity. Compromised sense. Not, you know, a complete being out of reality and not, understanding or acknowledging that, you know, that something's wrong here. You know, like when you have a psychosis, you don't understand that what you're experiencing is not real and is basically made up. When you have a dissociative disorder, you know that something's wrong and something's not right. Briefly, you may not know, but eventually you will, or you do. Okay? So it is best described as a compromised sense of reality or identity, either temporarily or in the short term or long term. Okay? Depersonalization, derealization is more in the short term. dissociative identity disorder can be more in the short term, in the sense of, there's frequent shifting back from one personality to the other and eventually to the real personality. And then the long term could be something more like dissociative amnesia. Okay? However, unlike psychosis, a person knows that something is wrong or not right about the detached experience. They know that this experience is not actual reality. Even people with dissociative identity disorder will know when they switch into a different personality. And, even though during that time they're under the influence of that different identity or that experience, they know that they're in that, different identity, and especially afterwards are able to say, like, yes, I was Jason during that time, or I was 8-year-old Sam during that time. Okay? All right. Psychoactive drugs, sleep deprivation, severe anxiety, and trauma can all result in a dissociative experience. We've talked about panic attacks, and if you go back to those criteria for panic attacks, one of the criterion is derealization, that these people often will have this experience of being in a dreamlike state when they have a panic attack. So severe anxiety. If any of you have ever pulled all-nighters studying for exams, or for any other reason, and the next day you kind of feel like you're in a dream state, you don't feel like, you're in reality, that is a dissociative experience. It's a more mild one, but it is a dissociative experience. And some people who have severe sleep problems, like severe insomnia, that can actually be, a pretty significant experience. And then certainly psychoactive drugs can create that, okay? And trauma. Having a brief dissociative experience is not abnormal or atypical. So, like, let's say, you don't have one because of, you're under the influence of drugs, or you're sleep deprived, or you have severe anxiety, or anything else. From time to time, it's normal for us to kind of have this brief feeling of detachment or derealization, where we're kind of feeling a little in a dreamlike state and we snap out of it. Maybe it only happens for about 10 to 20 seconds, and it, it's very rare, but just once in a while, out of the blue, we're just kind of in la la land and feeling like, oh, what the heck? Where am I? What's going on? And that is actually quite common. I think they estimate like 50% of us, have those experiences once in a while. So don't freak out if you have one of those experiences briefly. It doesn't mean you have a dissociative disorder. They're actually quite rare. These disorders are best explained by psychodynamic theory and unconscious motivations. Just like with some of the somatic-related disorders, such as conversion disorder and somatic symptom disorder. So, in many of the disorders that we've reviewed, it seems like, there's a bias in psychology towards cognitive behavioral explanations, because they do a really good job of explaining a lot of psychological disorders and symptoms, and are very effective in treating the large majority of them. But there are some disorders where they just do not explain them very well, and the disorders that seem to be more as a result of some kind of unconscious, subconscious process are the ones that are better explained by psychodynamic therapy. Cognitive behavioral therapy doesn't have too much of a place here. It really seems more evident that with some of the somatic disorders that we've talked about, conversion disorder that used to be called hysteria, where, a person can suddenly have a limb that's paralyzed and they can't move it and they have no idea why, and it's resulting from psychological processes. There's really, cognitive behavioral explanations talk more about the conscious process, obviously those kind of processes are not conscious. Same thing with, dissociative identity disorder, dissociative amnesia. Like, these are just not conscious kinds of processes. These are things that result from deep-seated psychological problems. Okay? And you're going to see why. So we're going to talk about that now. I'm sorry, we're going to talk about that soon. All right. Oh, and also, that's why the dissociative disorders are included in the somatic related disorders chapter 6, because they do tend to share that level of not being fully psychologically aware of why these things are happening to the person or the genesis of these problems. Okay, let's look at some prevalence rates. These are pretty rare disorders on the whole. The lifetime rate for depersonalization, derealization disorder is anywhere, according to the research, from about estimated to be 0.8 to 2.8%. So pretty rare. It shares a high comorbidity rate for with other disorders. So it's not very common to have this disorder and nothing else. Usually people with this disorder also have some kind of anxiety condition or some other kind of psychological disorder as well. And then this just becomes like a cluster of associated symptoms that warrant a separate diagnosis because they're so severe, you know. Then we have dissociative amnesia. This is estimated anywhere between 1.8 to 7.3%. When you see this wide range, it usually means that they're just not really so sure about the prevalence rate, and that the research that they have is minimal, and is, you know, not involving a large sample of people. So it's just a best guess, really. Okay. And then dissociative identity disorder. With a 1 year estimate is about 1.5%, they believe, in the population. So a very rare disorder. And it is a disorder that afflicts females to a far greater degree than men. It's a 9-to-1 ratio between females and males. And this is very fascinating. The average number of identities or personalities, if you will, in dissociative identity disorder is 15. That sounds like a lot, right? That means the average person with dissociative identity disorder has about 15 different personalities or identities. Fascinating. Okay. Moving on to slide 7. Let's talk about what the research has alluded to in terms of some causes here. Well, the diathesis stress model that we talked about way back when we were talking about, I believe, anxiety conditions, and actually applies to many, many, many of the different disorders. You know, if you remember way back when, it basically says that it's a combination between a diathesis, which is basically a biological vulnerability, and a stressor that happens in the person's life that combine to create the disorder. And we see that as being an explanation for the large majority of these kinds of disorders. That it's not just a biological susceptibility, and it's not just the stressor that somebody experiences. Often it needs to be both. Both things have to happen in order for a disorder to occur. At least that seems to be where the most evidence lies, right, for that explanation for most of the disorders. For depersonalization derealization disorder, there is some evidence of abnormalities in brain functioning related to poor perception and the neuroendocrine system related to reduced emotional responding and regulation. So, you know, when you're looking at this, you're saying, okay, so, you know, that would explain why they have the, you know, the, this this these this poor perception, you know, in terms of these abnormal perceptual experiences that make them feel that they're not in reality, or that, you know, they're in this dreamlike state, right? And then the second part of this, you know, really alludes to some possible explanation. And again, it's correlational research, so we can't say that this causes it. It certainly could be psychological factors that cause these biological changes. But what is also found to be related to this is very interesting because they're saying reduced emotional responding or regulation, okay, that neuroendocrine system that is involved in that, right, is leading to a reduction in emotional responding and regulation. So what would that have to do with this depersonalization, derealization disorder? Well, if they're not emotionally responding in a normal way, right, or regulating emotions in a normal way, okay, then that may explain why these experiences happen. So it's very similar to like the somatic related disorders, and especially like the conversion disorder and the somatic symptom disorder, in terms of, this lack of awareness of their emotional responses or feelings, right? A lack of awareness of underlying emotions or feelings. That, it's kind of like this metaphor that, you can lay cement, over the ground, but at some point, if there are weeds underneath, they're going to find a way out, right? And they're going to eventually capitalize on eventual cracks in the cement, and they're going to come through. In other words, you can cover up the weeds, but eventually they're going to come through. Over time, as a cement, goes through a wear and tear process and breaks down, the weeds will come through. And so it's an interesting metaphor to use with this too, that, you can push down emotions and you can say, I don't want to feel this way. I don't even want to acknowledge those feelings because they're yucky. I don't like them. But they're going to come through one way or the other. So if you don't acknowledge your feelings, then some pretty weird stuff is going to happen. You could have a sudden paralysis of a limb, as in conversion disorder, or some other weird physical symptoms, such as somatic symptom disorder. Or you could have these kinds of experiences, such as depersonalization, derealization disorder, where every now and then you suddenly feel like you're not in reality and you're in this dreamlike state. So, in other words, the emotions will have an impact on you one way or the other. They're either going to have an impact on you directly, in the sense of you having some kind of anxiety condition or depressive disorder, or they're going to have an impact on you indirectly, and they're going to come through in these unusual physical kinds of experiences and symptoms, or these unusual kinds of perceptual experiences. So, in other words, people with depersonalization, derealization disorder, one of the problems may be that they're not dealing with emotions. They're not, allowing the expression of their emotions. They're not responding to these emotions. And so these emotions seep out in this unusual way. And also, very similar for dissociative identity disorder, that have found some other types of biological abnormalities. There is some evidence for a smaller size hippocampus, which is involved in processing memories, and a smaller size amygdala, which is involved in processing and storing emotionally arousing experiences. So, again, it's correlational research, so it could very well be the case that these people have not processed some memories, let's say childhood memories or what have you, and have not processed fully or stored fully different kinds of emotionally arousing experiences that they've had in their life. And so, since they haven't, adequately processed these experiences, they kind of seep out in this other unusual way, that they have this other way of coming out. In other words, if you're not going to properly process emotions, you're not going to properly process traumatic memories and experiences, unfortunately, they're most likely going to come out in another way then. Okay, and these unusual indirect kinds of ways. Why would a hippocampus and amygdala become smaller? Well, that saying, if you don't use it, you lose it, right? If you're not using the hippocampus as much or the amygdala as much for processing emotions because, or I'm sorry, yeah, for processing and storing emotionally arousing experiences or certain kinds of emotionally arousing memories, then in effect, they may get smaller. Those structures may kind of shrink because you're not using them as much. So interesting biological research for these kinds of disorders. And that kind of alludes to the reasons that these disorders happen is because people are not dealing with or acknowledging or processing emotions, distressful emotions or experiences, etc., etc., etc. So you can kind of see where this might be going, right? In terms of some psychological causes. For depersonalization, derealization, my guess, they don't have a lot of evidence on this, but my guess with my clinical experience is that this is used to check out. That's the function that people use this for. They're not aware of it. It's an unconscious motivation, right? But it's used to check out when one's anxiety or stress level is too high, as if to serve a protective function in people with a very low tolerance for negative feelings, like people with anxiety and mood disorders. Not coincidentally, a lot of people with depersonalization, derealization disorder have an underlying anxiety and mood condition. So, this could be, kind of like almost a defense mechanism. In terms of, I don't want to deal with these, yucky feelings. And so therefore, I'm going to push them down. But because I'm pushing them down and I'm not acknowledging them and I'm not really, being in touch with who I really am, makes me vulnerable to having these experiences of feeling like, I don't recognize myself. I don't recognize my surroundings. Who am I? What am I? What's going on here? Okay, so that may explain, that condition and these other conditions as well. In fact, one study found that 73% of people with depersonalization, derealization disorder had a mood disorder, and 64% had an anxiety disorder. Dissociative amnesia. This often results from extreme stress or trauma and can involve forgetting the events, the emotional reaction, or one's entire identity, again, as a defense mechanism. So I said that these kind of go almost in order of severity. So if people with depersonalization, derealization disorder often have underlying anxiety and mood conditions, people with dissociative amnesia often have experienced an extreme trauma, similar to people with post-traumatic stress disorder. Okay? And so, why does one person develop post-traumatic stress disorder where they're constantly having flashbacks and they have not been able to kind of repress or forget, so to speak, the traumatic experience? Why do some people with traumatic childhood experience have PTSD and others have this? It may have to do with the personality trait that we refer to as suggestibility. And suggestibility means that the person is more easily influenced by fantasy or mental directives by either the self or other people, as in the case of hypnosis, that they're suggestible, okay, to kind of, being, influenced in terms of by another person putting them under hypnosis or themselves putting them under their own kind of hypnosis in terms of checking out and not remembering the event. Okay? For dissociative identity disorder, so now if we're going from least to most severe, In these cases, almost always, this is a result of repressing memories of extreme childhood abuse or trauma. If people with dissociative amnesia have experienced trauma, people with dissociative identity disorder have usually experienced trauma to the 10th degree. It's extreme, extreme trauma. And this again is a type of defense mechanism, but much more elaborate than just forgetting or checking out. You know, it's not just like in dissociative amnesia, they're forgetting about the event or aspects of the event or checking out for a moment of time, as in depersonalization, derealization disorder. They have this elaborate defense mechanism where they've literally created different identities that they can kind of switch into as a defense mechanism for staying in their true personality. Why would somebody not want to be themselves? Why would somebody not want to stay in their own personality? Well, if they didn't like that person because, the experience of that natural self was too traumatizing or too upsetting to acknowledge because, you know, that true self, that true person who they really are, you know, is a person who went through the most horrific kinds of abuse, the most horrific kinds of trauma, right? And so I don't want to be that person. I want to pretend I'm not that person because that person is associated with horrible experiences. So now I'm going to create these other people and I'm going to switch into them. And the more identities I have to switch into, the less time I need to be with that person, my true self. I don't want to spend time with that person. That person has a horrific life and they have had a horrific experiences. You know, I don't want to know that person. And so that's the defense mechanism. Are they consciously aware that that's why they're doing this? Absolutely not. No. We would say that their unconscious created this elaborate defense mechanism unbeknownst to them consciously. So, you know, the person essentially becomes these different people and identities and switches into these different personalities to limit them from experiencing their true self. And again, we're going to say that people that are able to have this kind of defense mechanism to create it probably also have this suggestibility trait. Because not all people who have gone through extreme, extreme trauma develop dissociative identity disorder. The patient I told you about that used to be sexually abused for years and years and years, starting when she was only 6 years of age. She developed PTSD, you know, not dissociative identity disorder. So why does she develop PTSD and not this? Probably because she doesn't have these other psychological vulnerabilities, such as a suggestibility trait, and maybe other psychological reasons. Okay? As far as looking at this from a developmental lens, particularly dissociative identity disorder, this almost always forms by age 9, which suggests that early childhood is a very sensitive period for developing this condition. Dissociative identity disorder can be looked upon as a regressed or stalled stage of emotional development. In support of this notion, many people with DID have, quote, personalities that are childlike or children. So in other words, you know, if somebody has experienced some kind of extreme trauma or emotional abuse, after age 9, it's very unlikely they're going to develop this. Usually this is going to be developed during childhood, this kind of disorder. Okay, so that would be a sensitive period for developing this kind of disorder. So what do we do about these disorders? How the heck do we treat these? Well, medication has not been found to be very effective for these conditions. And I'm sure a lot of you probably guessed that. Just like with the somatic-related disorders, medication was not very effective for them either. It almost seems to be, when you're dealing with disorders that are primarily rooted in unconscious drives and motivations, medication doesn't do a whole lot for them. Now, certainly, medication could help the other conditions that they have, like if they suffer from an anxiety disorder or a depressive disorder, certainly could help that. And then by taking care of those symptoms, we can focus more directly on, these kind of conditions. So it could be helpful indirectly, but not directly for ameliorating the symptoms, particularly of these disorders. Cognitive behavioral therapy, here's no surprise, not very effective unless you're talking about helping the patient deal with ordinary stressors better, by teaching them more effective coping skills so that the problem is not compounded. So, you're already dealing with these, conditions that are very debilitating. So let us at least try to make sure there aren't other things going on in your life that are exacerbating these conditions or making life worse for you. So cognitive behavioral therapy could help by teaching coping skills and that kind of thing. But as you may have guessed by all our talk about unconscious processes, psychodynamic therapy is really, in my opinion, the superior treatment option for dissociative disorders, especially for dissociative amnesia and dissociative identity disorder, the more severe ones. It's very possible that for depersonalization derealization disorder, if you treat the comorbid anxiety depressive disorder and you teach them some better skills and strategies to deal with, or you teach them to not get as bothered by these experiences when they do occur, since they don't occur for too long, that that may be enough for depersonalization derealization disorder. But for the more severe ones, you really are going to need to go deep down and dig up some of those traumatic experiences and have the patient work through them. Okay? So you could do that through hypnosis, right? Especially these people tend to be more suggestible, so hypnosis tends to work for them. Through hypnosis, you can help these people recall and remember their traumatic events, which I know may sound bad, like, oh gosh, why would you want them to reveal, to remember these horrible things that have happened to them? Because, as we stated, as the weeds will find a way to come through cement that starts to crack in different areas, these defense mechanisms are not impenetrable. There are cracks in these defense mechanisms, so to speak, and these weeds are going to go come through one way or the other. So your best bet is to deal with them directly and head on. So with psychodynamic therapy, you're going to use hypnosis and other insight-oriented techniques to really identify the trauma that they experienced, to get them to recall and remember it, to get them to recall and remember different cues and triggers for this kind of trauma, all the things that are related to it, and ultimately have them relive it and work through it, which is very similar to the exposure-based therapy that we use for, let's say, PTSD. But with the difference that in PTSD, they already remember a lot of the events that have happened to them and the details. This, you're getting them to remember them through some very depth-oriented techniques such as hypnosis and other kinds of insight-oriented techniques, such as, really asking them strategic questions to really kind of almost, force them to remember these kind of situations. And I'm not saying forcing them in the sense of against their will, forcing in terms of forcing against these strong defenses that don't want them to acknowledge it. That's what you're fighting against, the defense mechanism. You're not trying to, fight against their, consenting for this therapy. You're fighting against the defense mechanisms because they're very powerful and firmly ingrained. And the ultimate goal then is so that this material no longer is repressed or can become repressed again, because once it's fully acknowledged and remembered, that's it. They can't use these defense mechanisms anymore. And then for DID, dissociative identity disorder, you're also going to take it a step further and work on reintegrating personalities and identities with directive therapy techniques, such as identifying the true self, having it directly interact with the personalities, maybe possibly translating these personalities into the feelings and experiences that they represent. In other words, like, this personality that this person has, which is young Jane, who's a 7-year-old personality, trying to, basically expose that personality for what it is. It's not a separate personality or identity. It represents a feeling. What does a 7-year-old girl feel, right? Or what does any 7-year-old feel? They feel vulnerable, right? They're a young child. They feel vulnerable. They don't feel so in control of the world. So getting them to interact with those personalities and understand that they're not really separate identities, they're really just separate feeling states. And this is kind of how we work on reintegrating these personalities. I am glossing over the treatment very quickly, so understand that, I am not doing it due its due diligence in terms of what really the therapy entails to do that. We're not talking about several weeks or several months. We're talking about years of, serious therapy to, kind of ameliorate this kind of condition. Okay? All right. That ends today's lecture.